It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Coro Center for Civic Leadership is marking 20 years in Pittsburgh this year. Joining us is its newly appointed executive director, Selena Schmidt. Selena, welcome to The Confluence.
Oh, thank you very much, Kevin. I'm excited to be here.
This isn't your first stint with Coro. You previously served as a trainer for the Fellows Program. What was it about Coro that brought you back?
Well, you know, people have been asking me that question a bit, and I don't think I've ever really left Coro. My experience there, of course, certainly the skills, but the community, the commitment to deep learning, looking at things from multiple sectors and multiple sides, really has become a part of who I am. And so, if anything, it's more of a coming home than coming back.
Coro's mission is based on that interconnectedness of communities. How important is that factor in building strong leaders, relying on the strength of other communities?
I think we can take a look around today and recognize one of the critical things that we need from agile leaders is the ability to see, understand, and bring together the unusual suspects so that we can build complex solutions for the complex problems that we have. Mm-hmm. It's not one-dimensional. We really need to be able to see from multiple sides, and that also means understanding ourselves as a part of that process.
Realizing Coro has several programs, but really, what is the organization all about?
Well, our programs are designed around a handful of principles. First and most importantly, that we are cohort and experiential learning. That means we're putting people together in places that they can actually practice the real skills that we have immediately in real time, but they also are learning from people who are very different from each other. We intentionally build cohorts that give you multiple points of view so that you learn not just about you, but about the way others see these issues and different competencies that we're working to build.
So the fellows are learning from one another as well as the communities they serve?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That cohort learning is really intentional for us. What we want to make sure that we do is that we bring together that lived experience from so many places. Often, we end up in our bubbles, and in today's world, more and more. If we can bring together a group of people that are working, actively working to build a community within their cohort in addition to learning, that's a very different experience. And we do that in all of our programming.
Mentorship, networking, all those factors?
Yes, and.
Yes, and.
We do that. And we do have a really robust network. Just here in the greater Pittsburgh area, we have over 2,500 people that have participated in one of our programs, which is amazing. But that's also hundreds of organizations that they've worked with, hundreds of leaders that they've gotten to meet along the way. And Coro is also one of four centers across the country. So it's a national network to be able to connect to as well.
Okay. Where are those others? I believe the first one was in San Francisco.
Yes. San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. So Pittsburgh being a city that certainly maybe 20 years ago we might not have thought about as changing the world, we are definitely an important inflection point in national and in global conversations. So, of course, Coro needs to be here.
Do those other Coro centers, do they take a similar approach in finding new leaders to train, or is it different from center to center?
There are core elements, and we do have one core national program, which most people know of as the Coro Fellows Program, that runs across the country. It's actually a national cohort in addition to its small cohorts in each city. But each center is uniquely positioned to also help meet the leadership needs of the region. So, for example, Coro Pittsburgh has done some intentional programs with particular neighborhoods, building non-traditional leaders. So, and also here, we've done a lot of work in conjunction with Public Allies, which is an AmeriCorps program, that means that you don't have to have a particular education pedigree to be able to be a leader in the nonprofit sector.
So do some things differently, better even?
Well, I very much appreciate my colleagues. They do some great things. I do also love that we learn from each other. The Pittsburgh Center has really been an innovator in a lot of ways for the things that we've developed here that have spread to other centers. But I've got to say, there are some things that I've been eyeing up that they're doing in other places that could really make a difference here in New Pittsburgh.
So there is collaboration among the centers.
Absolutely.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is the new executive director for the Pittsburgh Coro Center for Civic Leadership, Selena Schmidt. Selena, to you, what makes a good leader? The best leader?
I hesitate to say best because so many of our bests are ideas of what leadership looked like throughout our growing up or throughout history. And leadership in today's world can't simply rely on what best practices have been in the past. We need to open that definition. So when I look at our programs, we've got folks in our program across the years that have ranged from 17 when they were first interviewed to 72. It's not necessarily one thing. And that's one of the critical pieces. We believe that difference is a resource. And if we can learn how to use it in collaboration, we can do so much more. So that's a fundamental piece. Another is critical inquiry. One of the pieces that's absolutely essential for leadership is to be able to step back, be reflective, ask meaningful questions, and also be able to adjust and pivot. That allows you to be agile in real time, and also allows you to be ethical and learn along the way. What we know about what it is to be an ethical leader today is different than what we might have thought about 25 years ago. And we need to keep growing and getting better.
Those qualities that you just mentioned, agility, open to inquiry, are they qualities you look for in all of your programs, or is that for your flagship program, the Coro Fellows?
Well, it certainly was the birth of the whole Coro idea was the Coro Fellows. But absolutely, what we also recognize is that it comes in different ways. So an effective leader might be somebody who is quick to take the mic or a good communicator, but it also might be somebody who likes to be in the background, who understands the systems. And systems thinking is also an important part of what we do, learning how organizations, how neighborhoods, how communities function, and not in just one sector, but how the real interplay happens to make change.
Mm-hmm. The main fellowship program is a year long, correct?
It's actually at 9 months.
Okay, 9 months.
9 months full time.
What's it usually include? Who's it for?
Well, it could be for anyone. I remember a great story about a gentleman in Northern California who was a successful surgeon who wanted to pivot and to become a public servant. And at 52, he went through the Coro Fellows program.
Oh, my.
Now, the program is unique because it brings together, I said, that national pool of extremely, a cohort that's built to be extremely different from educational background to geography and also point of view, type of leadership style. They rotate through a series of different placements, sort of mini immersions that are also consulting opportunities for organizations. So they will spend time in a nonprofit, in a for-profit, in a government. They'll do complete immersion weeks in different communities, and they'll also learn specific issues. Throughout that time, they'll have a lived experience in each of those sectors, and they'll also be learning from each other and their experiences. It's an incredibly deep and robust opportunity to learn about public affairs.
I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest on The Confluence is Selena Schmidt, Executive Director of the Pittsburgh Coro Center for Fellowship. You also offer, I believe it's a 5-month-long program called Women in Leadership.
Yes.
What's different about this program than the traditional fellows program you were just describing?
Oh, I'm glad that you asked about it. We're actually starting to recruit for our 2020 class right now. We realized early in our time here in Pittsburgh that what we needed was not just full-time programs. Not everyone can take the luxury of a year off to dedicate fully to themselves in leadership. So we developed a variety of different part-time programs. Women in Leadership does span 5 months, but it's also truncated in time. We do those seminars in the evenings. They work together in cohorts on the weekend. We want to make sure that it's accessible to people wherever they are in their career path. Now, that program is also a regional program, so that is not selected nationally. Those are for women that are here in the greater Pittsburgh region.
Mm-hmm.
But also still, instead of rotating through placements, our cohort is very intentionally nonprofit, for-profit, government, entrepreneurs to bring together that same sort of cross-sector synergy.
So cross-sector, but who is intent for? Young professionals, mid-career, maybe people starting new ventures, or those looking to hone their leadership skills for jobs they already have?
The short answer is yes. When we can bring together those perspectives, it makes a big difference. And there's really, Kevin, that when we look across programs, so many of them are sort of, again, put into bubbles by where you are in your career or where you are in age. When we can get cross-generational as well as cross-sector groups and cohorts together, the learning is just exponential.
How do you support the development of neighborhood leaders who are already committed to their community?
Commitment to community is an essential piece of leadership in neighborhoods. What often happens, though, is neighborhood leaders are in the trenches doing the work and don't have a time to step back and reflect. Or they might be connected to one particular issue and not understand how the other systems around them are impacting it.
Mm-hmm.
So when we can pull together a neighborhood leaders cohort, perhaps it's one of the main leaders in the neighborhood is the barber. Right, and he's connecting to so many different people in so many different ways. They may not even see themselves as a leader because it's something that's natural. What we can do is bring together so many different kinds of people, let them understand their leadership role and how they can amplify that by connecting with others.
It's interesting. They might not see themselves as a leader, but I bet you their friends and neighbors in that community see them as leaders.
Absolutely.
Right. You also partner with some graduate programs. How does that work?
Well, we've been very fortunate. Carnegie Mellon University has recognized the value of this cross-sector partnership that we build. And they've actually offered some really remarkable opportunities for our participants in the Fellows Program to come to the Heinz School. What's nice about that is because the Fellows Program is national, we've actually been able to attract some fellows from across the country to the greater Pittsburgh area through that program, many of whom have made some incredible impacts here in our community. We've been fortunate to have that as well.
CORO's mission mentions diversity and inclusion. Are targeted programs like the Women's Leadership Program, like the Neighborhood Leadership Program, are they part of this goal? How do they work toward achieving that?
Yes, very much so. And I think it's important when we look at Pittsburgh and the greater Pittsburgh region right now, the conversation that we're having about the stark disparities that we have in our communities based on a number of different factors, whether it be race, whether it be age, gender, even the conversations about rural, suburban, urban divide, we've got real challenges. And so what we want to make sure that we're doing as a center that is devoted to this region is looking at where we can make the biggest impact. Where can intentional cohort building, systems thinking, critical inquiry build the next generation of leaderships and solutions where people can work together in coalition? That's critical if we're going to solve these complex problems.
Less than a minute left. What could Pittsburgh do more of, maybe do differently, do better to encourage and develop leadership skills, especially among women and people of color?
First of all, I go back to the question that you asked. What makes the best leader? There's not one answer. Pittsburgh has a great history of problem solving and people who came from all different backgrounds to make incredible change across the globe. We still have that here. We can't make one kind of leader the right kind of leader. We need to bring people together to make a difference.
And very briefly, you mentioned earlier you're recruiting now for the Women's Leadership Program. How can people get in touch?
The best way is through our website, which is www.coropittsburgh, spelled all the way out with the H, .org.
And we will have a link to that website on our website, WESA.FM. Selena Schmidt is the new executive director of the Pittsburgh CORO Center for Civic Leadership. Thanks for your time.
Kevin, thank you so much for having me here today. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh area native Nellie Bly begins her voyage around the world in 1889. Bly's real name was Elizabeth Jane Cochran, who once wrote for the Pittsburgh Dispatch. She was a talented journalist who was determined to travel the globe quicker than the 80 days written in the fictional book by Jules Verne. With a small toiletries bag and a few changes of clothes, she boarded a ship in New York and took the nearly 25,000-mile trip. She traveled via train and steamboat and even bought a monkey while in Singapore. She traveled back to New York 72 days and 6 hours and 11 minutes later. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today we meet the creator of a book club conceived out of a need to organize literacy programming in the community. The Young Dreamers Book Club brings families together to fellowship over books while teaching young people that reading is a key to accessing their dreams. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports.
Reading is just not a tool to help develop your dream, but reading is a tool to make the world a better place.
Dr. Noshikari Griffin L., founder of the Young Dreamers Book Club, is an advocate of literacy, especially among urban youth. His organization challenges young people to strive for greatness while learning. A Philadelphia native, Dr. Griffinell attended the University of Pittsburgh, started a family, and stayed in the area. He says the catalyst for the club stems from a personal experience than 2017.
My oldest son had a speech delay, and my wife and I were extremely dissatisfied with the support that the public school system in Pittsburgh was offering him. So one summer I told my wife, I said, I have an idea. I'm gonna keep the boys home for the entire summer, and I'm just gonna read to them.
From that, he noticed a greater issue of low literacy rates that needed to be addressed, and says both children and parents must work together to overcome that disparity.
64% of African-American children don't read at grade level from third to fifth grade. So this Young Dreamers Book Club was born out of the necessity to say, we need to make reading an integral part of our community fabric. So that means that kids need to see themselves as readers.
The club partners with the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh, and programs are set up in large gatherings around the city, and activities are assigned to be completed at home.
It's just a great connection with our mission here at the library and supporting children and families.
Mary Beth Parks, Children's Services Coordinator, works in conjunction with all 19 Carnegie Library locations. She says the addition of the Young Dreamers Book Club has improved programming across the board and enhanced the library's mission.
He's contributed content, book lists. We're just very happy to work with him and have him support the work on different projects, such as Black History Month, Martin Luther King Day, bilingual story times. So he's bringing so many elements and so many components into the library that support the work that we do.
Dr. Griffin L., who spent 3 years as a professor in South Africa before returning to Pittsburgh, says literacy is the gateway to dreams and overall participation in the democratic process. He says it's the gateway to a wealth of knowledge that no one can eradicate.
Literacy provides us with the opportunity to develop the personal agency to satisfy our curiosity, while at the same time, reading provides us with the ability to speak in an in-depth manner about things that are important while talking about the essence that these things represent.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Hi, I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence will be on hiatus the rest of this week, so WESA can bring you live special coverage from NPR of the House Intelligence Committee's hearings on the impeachment inquiry, every day starting at 9 a.m. In the meantime, if you have suggestions for interesting guests or important topics of discussion for The Confluence, email them to our full show team. That's confluence at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ethane from Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale is now getting exported to other countries. One of the first to import this gas was Scotland. Fracking is illegal there, but using fracked natural gas is not. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Fraser went to Scotland, where he found American shale gas is playing a role in the UK's own debate over fracking.
On a quiet street in central Scotland, Kevin Ross surveys a sprawling industrial plant.
You can see some of the flares down there operating, some of the silo towers across there, and some of the many cooling towers that are actually on site.
Ross is president of the Scottish Plastics and Rubber Association and runs a local plastics testing company. He's taken me to look at Grangemouth. This is Scotland's biggest petrochemical plant and refinery. It's built on the Firth of Forth, a wide river estuary that empties into the North Sea. And it's here where ships bearing American shale gas are brought into port.
It comes here, it is then taken off the ships and put into large storage tanks. The storage tanks are then used to supply the rest of the plant.
The plant is owned by INEOS, a European chemical company. The plant makes plastic and chemicals out of ethane, a common byproduct of oil and gas drilling. But its source for that gas, offshore wells in the North Sea, have started to run dry. So in 2016, it started shipping ethane from the U.S. Most of this gas originates in western Pennsylvania and crosses the state through the Mariner East, a pipeline whose environmental problems and use of eminent domain have drawn controversy. The gas is then exported through the Marcus Hook port facility near Philadelphia. With this new supply of shale gas, the Grangemouth plant has returned to full production. Ross says that's good not just for the 1,300 who work there, but for other businesses as well, including his own. Ross takes me to his company's lab, a few blocks from the plant.
These are climate chambers. They'll cycle from minus 40 to plus 100.
This place is a sort of torture chamber for plastic objects. Ross's company, Impact Solutions, tests the effects of heat, weight, and pressure on everything from artificial office plants to construction materials. He shows me what looks like a glossy plastic pipe.
Almost certainly, because of what it's made of, it's either nuclear, pharmaceutical, or military. Almost certainly, because it is so expensive.
So it's a pipe?
It is a pipe on steroids. It's a very high-performance pipe.
But it's not just companies that work with plastic that depend on the Grangemouth plant. There are other businesses, too.
Aye, cup of tea. Just some milk, please, aye.
At the Rumbling Tum food cart, Lindsay Breen cleans up after a day selling sandwiches and hot drinks. Breen said if Grangemouth were to ever slow down, so would her business.
The refinery, we get most of our customers for the refinery, and we have done for the past 25 years. So if the refinery was to close down, then it would make a big impact on our business because we depend on the workers from there to come here and be fed.
The refinery almost did close down a few years ago over a labor dispute, but INEOS won concessions from the union representing workers there and got hundreds of millions of dollars in government loan guarantees for retrofits that allowed the plant to import American shale gas. INEOS officials did not agree to an interview for this story, but in a company video, CEO Jim Ratcliffe says importing cheap American shale gas was just simple math.
You know, shale gas, you know, some of the gases that come out of shale gas are the sort of fundamental feedstocks for the world of chemicals. And those feedstocks now in America are a quarter of the price they are in Europe.
But the company still wants its own supply of cheap local gas and is pushing for fracking in the UK. Zoe Shipton, a geologist at Strathclyde University in Glasgow, was part of a team of researchers that studied the idea of fracking in Britain.
The sort of headline news is that there is potentially quite a lot of gas underneath the UK.
But just how much gas is unknown and can't be known unless there's more drilling. But that idea has been met with fierce opposition. Norman Phillip is with Friends of the Earth Scotland. He grew up in Grangemouth, where his father worked at the plant when it was owned by BP.
It was a boom town. Like, so people were moving in because there was work, there were social clubs, there was a buzz about the town. We were fueling the nation.
When INEOS tried to bring fracking to Scotland, Phillip and others opposed it over issues like earthquakes and climate change. The production of plastics makes up nearly 4% of all global CO2 emissions. He's also heard stories about fracking from people in the US and Australia.
People were telling us of gas leaks. They were telling us of children having headaches. And there was a toxic element of it.
As the pursuit of shale gas spread across the Atlantic, so too did arguments both for and against that are by now familiar in Pennsylvania. In the UK, the pushback to fracking led to a different result, though. In 2015, Scotland put in place a moratorium on fracking, and this month, the UK government in Westminster did the same. But INEOS still has licenses to frack in Scotland if the government were to ever change its mind. While fracking is illegal in Britain, it's still legal to import shale gas produced by fracking in the US. This bothers Norman Phillip.
Why should a community in America have to suffer what we've fought hard against? Oh, our slogans were no fracking here, no fracking anywhere.
Others are glad the INEOS plant is still running, even if they wouldn't want fracking nearby. Kenny Mullen is from the nearby town of Falkirk. Watching his son ride a bike at a park a few blocks from the Grangemouth plant, he says that when INEOS threatened to shut it down a few years ago, there was panic over the potential economic effects.
There was certainly, it was tangible. You could tell people were worried for their jobs and stuff like that.
Mullen says he's glad there's no fracking in Scotland, even though he's aware of the contradiction in his views.
I think most people are anti-fracking, myself included. We're happy to take the gas which has been obtained in that method from America, so it sounds really cutthroat just because they're making money out of it, you know?
If there were a way to get by without fossil fuels, he says, he'd be all for it. But for now, the gas arriving from the U.S. is keeping the plant and his town afloat. For State Impact Pennsylvania, I'm Reed Fraser in Grangemouth, Scotland.
Did President Trump abuse his power when he asked for an investigation into a political rival? Join NPR for continuing special coverage of the public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As the temperatures fall, we crank up our thermostats, but that's not an option for Pittsburgh's homeless. Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net, in partnership with the County Department of Human Services, has opened its winter shelter to provide a warm place to stay overnight for those experiencing homelessness. Dan Palka is the outreach team leader for Operation Safety Net. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, let's start with some logistics. Where is the shelter, the hours that it's open?
Sure. So the emergency shelter is at 620 Smithfield Street downtown, and it's open from November 15th to March 15th this winter, and it will operate from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. in the morning.
And that's the Smithfield United Church of Christ.
That's right.
The shelter used to be open when the temperature dipped to 25 or below. When did you switch to it being open for four straight months, no matter the temperature?
Right, so that was 3 years ago. Previously, it was based on, you know, honestly, an arbitrary sort of benchmark saying, you know, whatever temperature, if it's below this, then we'll open up. And now we're open every night of the term, four months, yeah.
For someone living on the streets, is there a meaningful difference between 27 degrees and 25?
No, we didn't distribute thermometers to everyone living outside, not a lot of people are privy to that anyway. So often people would show up to the doors and find it to be closed because of, maybe a degree or 2 degrees of difference.
All right, the shelter opened Friday. What preparations were needed to make it ready?
Well, first of all, we had to partner with a lot of different stakeholders in the community this year because of some issues regarding the space and occupancy. And it was actually a sort of heroic effort on behalf of the entire community because they were able to sort of group together and fix these things in an extremely short period of time. Action Housing, Department of Human Services, Mercy, URA, the mayor's office, everyone came together and really pulled this off in a short amount of time.
Safety, accessibility, what?
Yeah, so safety, it's often, cited that the fire code and the occupancy permit were sort of in variance, and so we had to make sure that we had sprinkler systems up and running in time for the November 15th open.
So is the work complete? Will you continue to do some during the course of those 4 months?
It will continue throughout those 4 months to sort of enhance the safety of the space. But by Friday, it had been approved, and so therefore we were able to continue on with the services.
You mentioned occupancy. So how many people can you accommodate?
Yeah, so tentatively it's 120 people, which includes men and women in the space.
About 40 people, I believe, spent the night last week at a makeshift shelter downtown when temperatures dropped to 17 degrees. The church wasn't prepared at that point. You officially opened on Friday. So Catholic Charities opened its downtown headquarters. That space usually serves as a warming center during the day. How do you take into account when winter arrives?
Right. So, we look at the seasons and how they seem to be changing. And this year, winter didn't begin on November 15th. So it was pretty cold last week. And we decided, hey, is there any way we can come together and, meet the needs of people who are living outside currently? And so Catholic Charities and the mayor's office and the police and Operation Safety Net, we all got together and pulled something off, in the order of something like 2 hours.
Right. So how tough was that when it was clear the temps were dropping and you weren't going to be able to open the doors to the regular winter shelter?
Well, So it was difficult, but not as difficult when you have people. I mean, Catholic Charities has been historically a wonderful partner with Pittsburgh Mercy and Operation Safety Net. And, you know, I called over there to Sister Irene, who's been a phenomenal ally in serving people who are living outside. And she was like, let's get on this. And, you know, within 2 hours, we were sitting with the board and they had unanimously agreed that this was something that warranted our attention.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking to Dan Palka of Operation Safety Net, which manages a downtown winter shelter throughout the cold season. Do you project how many Pittsburghers you might expect to serve during the next 4 months?
Yeah, so our occupancy is around 120.
Right.
However, throughout the 4 months, we see something more like 1,500 unique individuals that are served by the shelter. Mm-hmm. Some of them have, you know, one to five bed nights, and others are there throughout the duration of the season.
What you offer, it goes beyond a bed in a warm place.
Absolutely.
So, such as, give us an idea.
Well, so the really important thing to remember is that getting people into shelter is not just, you know, giving a press release, because, you know, many of the people that would actually utilize this space are not listening to WESA, for example. So outreach is one of the most important things that we can do to build relationships prior to the shelter opening, so that people are aware of these services, we have durable relationships with them, and that they trust that the same people who they've known out on the street or in the encampments will be in this space to sort of facilitate the provision of these services.
So you have a hot meal. Are medical concerns, medical issues taken into account?
Yeah, so we have a clinic every night of the week. And, you know, Dr. Jim Withers has provided this service for, you know, nearly 30 years. So people can trust that if they come in, they'll have medical attention. They'll be fed a hot meal. You know, we have case management services there. We have outreach there. And, you know, we have a lot of donations that come through from, you know, various organizations. And we're able to give them out and make sure people are, you know, fed, dry, and happy.
All right. You mentioned men, women. But many of our homeless neighbors, they have animal friends as well, don't they?
That's right. And so part of the unique feature, if you want to say, about the emergency shelter is that it's a low barrier shelter, which is different characteristically than some of the other more conventional models, which means, you know, you don't have to be sober, you don't have to have identification, et cetera. We just are looking to provide a safe place where people can get out of the cold. And that includes bringing whatever it is that makes you a unique individual, oftentimes a companion animal.
And so they are welcome. Do they pose any special challenges?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can remember 2 years ago where there was a gentleman who had a cane Corso with him. And, you know, he's sleeping next to a man who had a CPAP on. And it's just, you go through the shelter and you recognize that there are a lot of unique individuals with equally as unique needs.
You develop relationships with our homeless neighbors. You see them from year to year, and you'll be rekindling those relationships over the next handful of months.
Absolutely. There are plenty of individuals experiencing homelessness that don't engage with other formal service providers. And frankly, they also, after the shelter closes every year, may disappear. And we honestly don't know where they go. But something based on the relationships and historically the services we provide in that space, they'll return. And so it's sort of like a family reunion. Last week was, you know, a very special time because we got to see a lot of familiar faces.
Is there advice or counseling or even support for trying to acquire permanent housing?
Absolutely. Housing First is something that we prioritize, but we recognize also that individuals may not be ready for housing and that they certainly have other needs that we can meet as well.
So housing is not the panacea.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We've seen that time and time again. If you get someone housed without supportive services, they may languish.
At the end of a season, do you do an assessment of what you've offered? What changes might benefit you in future seasons?
Absolutely. At the end of every season, we look at, you know, what would it take to serve this population better? And I think just the idea that the season ends is problematic for us and this population. We would rather have a year-long low-barrier shelter where we wouldn't have to send people back out on March 15th, you know, to brave the elements again.
And you're assessing the situation. Mm-hmm. What about suggestions from your clients?
Absolutely. That's the probably the most important piece of all, and I think historically has been sort of underutilized, if we could convene something like a community advisory board of participants, they have a lot of really insightful feedback that we would love to see inform the programming that we do.
Dan Palka is the outreach team leader for Operation Safety Net. The winter shelter is now open from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. every night through March 15th at Smithfield United Church of Christ downtown. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Operation Safety Net welcomes community support for its winter shelter, including providing meals, winter clothing, and health care and social worker volunteers. More information is available at pittsburghmercy.org. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto formally introduced the city's proposed 2020 budget last week. Here to talk about what's included and what's not is WESA Government and Accountability Editor Chris Potter. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
So the big picture takeaway from the budget proposal the mayor has made is...
This is a modest budget in the sense that, I mean, it's over $600 million, but it's not a radical change in priorities from what we've seen in recent years. The city is expecting about a 3% increase in revenue through taxes, cost of living kind of adjustment, about 6% increase in what it's shelling out, which generally you would say that's not so great. But there's sort of an accounting quirk here that explains a lot of that increase. The city pays its employees every other Friday, and just the way the calendar happens to lay out in 2020, there's going to be one extra Friday there. So that's a lot of that increase. The mayor also released a capital budget, which is your kind of long-term infrastructure investment. Again, no great surprises. There's stuff like bridge reconstruction and things like that, and then some mayoral priorities like smart traffic lights and stuff like that. That's about $109 million.
Anything controversial in this budget?
Well, you know, I think we'll find out, first of all, if there's something really controversial. The city council now begins its hearings.
Right.
I think the first one is on Wednesday, and that takes place for the next few weeks. They have to have a budget done by the end of the year. Usually there's some kvetching, some complaining about priorities here and there. The numbers get tweaked a little bit. I think, though, that the big controversies we're likely to see in the weeks ahead are sort of what's not in the budget. Because the big thing that's on council's agenda is the voters passed this parks tax to raise their own property taxes a half mil. And now it's up to council to basically create the enabling legislation. There's supposed to be a trust fund that money goes into, and there are going to be a lot of conversations because there is a lot of concern about who would control that money, how it was being prioritized, how it would be spent, and a lot of that stuff I expect to be fairly controversial going forward.
During his budget address, Peduto promised once again to introduce his One Pittsburgh plan. Remind us, Chris, what is One Pittsburgh?
it's a feeling, it's a hope, it's a dream, it's an aspiration, it's a force that binds us all together. No one really knows what One Pittsburgh is going to be. The idea was, and it was an idea first suggested to me by the mayor's then chief of staff, Kevin Acklin, back in 2014.
5 years ago.
Yes, 5 years ago, as incredible as it is. I almost had a full head of hair back then. And the idea was, you know, I think we all know that UPMC and some of the other big nonprofits don't pay taxes. They're tax exempt, so they don't pay taxes. But of course, they're also among the city's biggest landholders and the biggest employers. So how do we get them to contribute more? And the idea is we'll set up sort of a fund that they can voluntarily contribute to support particular infrastructure investments or whatever to make the city a better place.
All right. So what will it include? We've heard this talked about like a panacea to cure all manner of Pittsburgh ills, from homelessness to hunger to police and even the nonprofit status of UPMC, which you alluded to.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's going to include. I mean, some time ago, a year ago, we saw some draft plans here at WESA, me and my colleague Margaret J. Krause report on some of those. But at this point, I feel like I know less about what's in this plan now than I did a year ago. It's just a big sort of question mark about what kind of priorities there will be. One thing we can say is this parks tax was envisioned in some of these draft plans. The voters would vote for their tax increase. The Parks Conservancy would find other money to contribute and join and sort of match those funds. What we've got right now is the voters have voted themselves a tax increase, but it remains to be seen where this outside money is going to come from.
All right. Mayor's office has been talking about the plan, as you said, since 2014. We still don't have a date for the launch. What are your projections for when or even if this thing happens?
Yeah, I mean, I really can't tell you. Earlier this year, we were told the next announcement would be the formation of the body that would oversee this fund. We still haven't seen that. That was supposed to happen in April. We're still not there. At this point, it would be foolish for me to guess. And the mayor himself has said, I've gotten burned every time I've tried to suggest a deadline, and I'm not going to do it anymore.
Chris Potter is WESA's Government and Accountability Editor. Chris, thanks so much
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. For the next few days at this time, WESA will present live NPR coverage of the House Intelligence Committee's public hearings on the impeachment inquiry. In the meantime, if you have suggestions for interesting guests, please email confluence@wesa.fm. Today's program was engineered by Tom Hurley, produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.